Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. KBOO's Doug McVeigh speaks with the author of the study, Drug Decriminalization, Fentanyl, and Fatal Overdoses in Oregon.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
A new article entitled Drug Decriminalization, Fentanyl, and Fatal Overdoses in Oregon was published September 5th in the American Medical Association's journal JAMA Network Open. It shows that the recent rise in overdose deaths in Oregon was not related to the decriminalization of possession of some drugs, but rather to the introduction of fentanyl to the drug market. To learn more, I spoke with the lead author, Michael Zurab, PhD.
My name is Michael Zurab. I'm a data scientist in New York City. I also am a consultant at Rhode Island Hospital doing research related to substance use epidemiology.
I've asked you on to talk about a new article of which your lead author entitled Drug Decriminalization, Fentanyl, and Fatal Overdoses in Oregon, which was published September 5th in the journal JAMA Network Open. Let's start from the top. What led you to look at the relationship between criminalization of people who use drugs and deaths due to a toxic, unregulated drug supply and drug overdose?
Yeah, I guess there's like a broad answer and a specific answer. The broad answer is that, as we all know, there's a big overdose crisis in the United States, and the sort of primary policy regime has been criminalization in the United States for many decades. And so, you know, when states experiment with new things, new public policies, that's something I'm interested in as a researcher. In general, I think the specific catalyst is prior work that's been done on this exact topic. So as listeners may know, you know, there have been a couple of prior studies that took a look at Measure 110 and its effects on overdose. And one thing that my co-authors and I noticed is that they didn't really systematically account for the spread of fentanyl to Oregon. So fentanyl, you know, first emerged in the eastern United States drug markets many years ago, around 2014. And as we show in the paper, it's sort of spread west gradually. Interestingly, in Canada, the reverse dynamic is true. It started in the west and spread east, but in the US, east to west. And, you know, it hit the West Coast around the same time as Measure 110. And we know, like from my prior work, from a lot of other work on this topic, that the thing that's driving, you know, the primary driver of year-to-year variation in overdose death rates between states is when the opioid market transitions from being primarily heroin-based to primarily fentanyl-based. And so we were surprised to learn that, you know, these prior studies, one of them in particular, basically never, you know, does not in any meaningful way account for this transition in drug supply and simply assumes that the overdose death changes that occurred in Oregon in 2021 were due to Measure 110, kind of overlooking this really important confounding variable. And yeah, we thought it was important to take a hard look at this problem, you know, while appropriately accounting for the role of fentanyl.
So what did you find?
Well, the paper does a few things. You know, first, like I said, we traced the spread of fentanyl across the United States from east to west. We show that Measure 110, which took effect at the beginning of 2021, pretty much coincides with fentanyl saturating the drug supply in Oregon. So we do a statistical analysis of drug seizures and show that fentanyl really spiked around that same time. That's the sort of first thing. Measure 110 occurs, you know, in some ways, quite unfortunately, at the same time that this transition in drug markets happened. That's the first thing we show. And the second thing we show, although I don't think this is a particularly surprising thing, it's just that, like I mentioned, you know, if you look at, if you try to model changes in overdose death rates between states over time, the primary, like, you can explain most of the variation with a measure of fentanyl exposure in recent years. I mean, this is really the primary driver of overdose death rates. The changes in overdose death rates between places on a short-term timeline. And so we sort of show that statistically. There's some visualizations in the paper to this effect. So I would say that's the second thing we find. We sort of replicate previous findings that show that overdose death rates increased in Oregon after measure 110. And then we show that if you, appropriately adjust for this change in drug supply, the transition from predominantly heroin to predominantly fentanyl, this effect goes away. And instead of finding, having a statistical model that finds a positive association between measure 110 taking effect in overdose death rates, we find, a result that is consistent with there being no effect. And so in the first 2 years after measure 110 took effect, our finding is that, our best guess, and there's some uncertainty about this, for sure, there's really not a lot of statistical power for, single state interventions and measuring their effects. But our estimate, the result is consistent with there being no effect on overdose death rates. And we can kind of rule out large changes in either direction. And then finally, there's sort of a supplementary analysis where we look at Washington State, which, as you may know, Washington State briefly, because of a court case decision, had a few months where drugs were possession of small amounts of drugs was decriminalized, and then they recriminalized drugs. And we sort of show that despite this much different policy trajectory from Oregon, overdose death rates trended in very much the same way. And so overdose death rates were increasing in Oregon, in Washington, around the time of the Blake decision that decriminalized drugs, and they continued increasing, and in fact increased mortality rates even accelerated in their increase after recriminalization. And we, to be clear, I don't think that's because of decriminalization and recriminalization. I really just think it's because of fentanyl. When you account for that, that's really what's explaining these big changes in overdose death rates on a short-term timeline.
Normally, I ask about the policy implications of your research, and I want to ask about that. But before I do, I want to ask you, what are the implications of your research for people who use drugs?
I mean, I don't think this is a particularly new insight for people who use drugs, but I think this really just underscores the importance of supply and how unpredictable and, toxic drug supply is a huge risk factor. And so to the extent that you have access to the ability to monitor drugs for contaminants, you should absolutely take advantage of that, because this is really what's killing people. I mean, one really interesting phenomenon of the fentanyl crisis is in many cities, there's been populations of people who've used heroin for decades. And when the drug supply transitioned from predominantly heroin to predominantly fentanyl, there was a really big spike in overdose death rates among these people who, although they likely had a cascade of problems that resulted in them, regularly using drugs for long periods of time, they were, living. But when the drug supply transitioned, it unfortunately, poisoned a lot of people. And so, we really have to be mindful of the fact that the drug supply is not safe. It's unpredictable. And, to the extent that you have access to resources that can help you monitor it and mitigate that risk, you should absolutely take advantage of those. From that perspective, I also think a lot of the sort of basic insight. I doubt that decrim reprim, this is not causing big changes in overdose death rates. I don't think that's a huge surprise to people who use drugs, but I'm not sure. I would just say that's the overall finding from my perspective, is that this policy change is not the first order thing explaining variation in overdose death rates.
Frankly, there are a lot of things that are pretty obvious to people who use drugs that the rest of the population probably don't understand. Things like supply and demand. It's not a demand-driven, it's not like consumers dictate, it's not the consumer who's dictating what's going to be available. The supermarket might care about what the consumer wants. This is the illegal market. What do you got? That's what you get. And that's this is the demand side that's it's the supply side that determines.
And there's no quality control, right? When an illicit market, what could have been a perfectly fine, not particularly problematic dose for a person 1 week, could be quite problematic later on, because it's just not even the same drug. or the same potency. And it's very much, you know, there are a lot of supply factors that are outside of the control of consumers in this context.
Let's go to the policy implications. What do you think, what are some of the policy implications of your research?
I think analyses are sort of postmortems on Measure 110 were premature in the sense that Measure 110 was blamed for an increase in overdose deaths that it likely did not cause. And I think there's, you know, a whole host of political and policy issues in the background here related to disorder, homelessness, and so on. My sense is that a lot of people in Oregon and beyond believe that decriminalization caused this big increase in overdose death rates. But if you zoom out and you really just look at the unfortunate sort of trajectory of overdose and mortality in the United States, what happened in Oregon in 2021 and 2022, and is still happening, is not particularly unusual. Other states saw similar or larger increases in overdose death rates without making any changes to how they criminalize possession of small amounts of drugs. And so I think policymakers should not assume that drug decriminalization leads to a big increase in overdose death rates. I think there's some other, and our paper engages with this much less, but I think it's also really important for policymakers to think about policy implementation in how they interpret Measure 110 in our paper and other papers. Because as you know, and your readers likely know, Measure 110 did not just change criminal penalties. It also allocated resources for treatment out of the taxes on adult use marijuana sales. But the, you know, resources to create new treatment, provide additional treatment, did not really meaningfully take effect for more than a year and a half after the initiative took effect.
What have I not asked that I should have?
I think one thing I really want to sort of get out there is that it's entirely possible that over the next 2-3 years, overdose death rates in Oregon plateau and start to decline, because that's what's happened in the eastern United States. And I think a lot of people may, in the same way that they misattributed the increase in overdose death rates in 2021 to Measure 110, when really it was this change in drug supply, I worry that people will similarly interpret the overdose death rate plateauing and beginning to decline as being the product of Measure 110. And I would just really want to stress to folks to like take a zoomed out view about what's happening in the other states and regions. Because what has happened in the rest of the United States is there was, you know, overdose death rates have been increasing, as you mentioned, for decades, but they really, really started increasing more rapidly around 2014 with fentanyl hitting the eastern United States. But in those regions, the crisis has sort of started to plateau and decline somewhat. And so we should expect something similar in Oregon after, you know, it's not going to be immediate. Like, we're still in the West Coast is still in the thick of this, and drug supply continues to change. But if Oregon is going to follow the trajectory of other states, something like that is quite likely. And so I just, you know, again, I think it's really important for people to have that context, because that it could well happen. And I think it would be a mistake to say that, you know, this change in policy is responsible for changes in overdose death rates, like substantial changes. Because if you sort of just look at what's happening throughout the United States, you see these patterns in places that did not, you know, make changes like what Oregon made with Measure 110.
You would probably see what we're seeing in Vancouver, BC. The population of people who use drugs are simply becoming accustomed to using fentanyl. And so now you have people who are seeking out fentanyl and using, it's an intentional thing. It's not just a toxin that's been added that's not been detected. People are making decisions to use this. I mean, it's a different kind of high.
And there's acclimation and So this sort of behavior starts to happen.
Yeah. And when they get used to what they're using, they're not going to die quite as quickly. But people still die.
Right. Exactly right.
So now, can people follow your work in social media? Do you have a website?
I'm on Twitter. My name, Michael Zurab, is my handle. I also have a personal website that I update infrequently. But it's also my name, Michael Zurab. I think you should also check out my co-authors and their work. So Brandon Del Pozzo, the corresponding author on this, he's also very, very active in public life. And the other authors, Ju Park, Alex Crow, and Barrett Montgomery, they're all on social media as well.
Any closing thoughts for the listener?
I guess my closing thought is to always zoom out. And we can often think that what's happening in our communities or in our state is really extraordinary and exceptional. And sometimes it is, but sometimes it's actually quite ordinary. And it takes that kind of systematic comparison with other places to really learn what's special and what should be expected.
Dr. Zurab, thanks.
Thank you. My pleasure speaking with you. It's been a lot of fun.
I've been speaking with Michael Zurab, PhD, a data scientist in New York City and lead author of an article published September 5th in the journal JAMA Network Open entitled Drug Decriminalization, Fentanyl and Fatal Overdoses in Oregon. Reporting for KABU News, I'm Doug McVeigh.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Today, I'm speaking with Laura Grimes, Executive Director at Oregon Arts Watch, about an opinion piece she published. It's called The Arts Community Has a Lot at Stake in the Election That Will Reshape Portland City Hall. What can you tell me about this piece and the thinking that went into it?
Yeah, so the general election coming up in November will have an opportunity to completely reshape City Hall in that the City Council will grow from what is now 5 members, 4 commissioners and the mayor, to 12 members. So there will be 3 representatives from 4 different districts, and the mayor will now work with the city administrator and not be part of the council. But also, because 4 of the city commissioners, out of 4 of them, 3 of them are running for mayor, and 1 of them is running for a new council seat. So it means a whole new leadership will take over City Hall. And they're thinking that maybe they don't have a background about the impact that the arts have on the city. So a group of arts leaders across the state, across the city, has come together to sort of put together information to help inform a lot of these new leaders who will take charge of the city in January.
Can you give me a little bit of the structure of how the arts community and the government interact in the current day and how you might expect that to change coming in 2025?
A lot of the arts community in the city is in flux right now because the Regional Arts and Culture Council oversees the Tri-County area, which is Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties. And the city had been funding a large portion of the operating costs of RAC, like more than 80%. A year ago, the city said that it was not going to continue funding RAC. And RAC had been established in 1995, so it meant that what they offered the rest of the arts community was going to be severely diminished. That funding ended in June of this year, and now RAC has sized down its staff, and the city has decided that it will now decide how it's going to allocate funding to arts groups. It has set up some new granting structures that are going to be taking effect, and RAC will be able to continue to distribute some small grants at one time. But I know that RAC is now having conversations about what its future role will be. It had been supporting the whole Tri-County area, but now it's looking that maybe it won't distribute grants anymore, and where should its focus be now? So it is in flux. At the same time, the city adopted in May a new cultural plan for the future called Our Creative Future, which had been in the process for a couple of years. It involved a lot of listening sessions throughout the Tri-County area. It had been led by the city, although it is somewhat endorsed by several of the other governments around the region. So it has a whole new plan to help to guide the future. So it's kind of depends on how much of the new city council leaders know about this plan and know how that's going to relate to all of the arts groups. This arts groups have a huge impact on the economy, on revitalization, on enhancing the city. It has an identity as being known as a creative city. It's a key part of our brand. So how does that look going forward, and how much the arts community is going to be engaged with these leaders is still a big question mark.
I want to address that point directly, because there's so much talk about, oh, we need to revitalize Portland, we need to revitalize downtown, and the arts community and that reputation and venues are such a big part of that. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, so also a lot of the venues are in flux right now. The Keller Auditorium needs to have earthquake enhancements made. And it's possible that it could take up to 2 years to renovate it. And if that happens, that means that it would shut down for the Broadway shows that come through town, which support more than 50% of the rest of the Portland 5 venues. Out of those 5, it supports 50% of that. So it's a huge economic chunk to support the rest of those areas. Also, a lot of people work in the Keller Auditorium, and it's an important piece of people's, you know, livelihood. So if that were to shut down for 2 years, that's huge. Also, when you shut down a venue, it means a change in audience behavior. Do they adopt those habits again? You have to build up those habits again to be able to come back. At the same time, it also means that Portland Opera and Oregon Ballet Theater would have to find someplace else to perform. It would displace them. What would happen? What can they do? How they now perform in big halls and they have big audiences. It would mean a huge reduction in their audiences and revenue. So it has a huge impact. A couple of other proposals have been floated, one at Lloyd Center and one at Portland State University, which and the one at Portland State University looks especially promising because they have planned for both a bigger hall, similar in size to the Keller Auditorium, and a smaller venue, about a 1,200-seat performing arts space. And they're looking at a hotel space. So it's 5 blocks from where Keller is now. There's also a whole push to renovate Keller Hall because it has a historical significance with the fountain across the street. So there's a big push for that. So the city is supposed to decide on what's happening with the Keller, and they have now pushed back the decision to October. They were supposed to decide in August, and now they have pushed it back again. So what the plan is there is still up in the air. The debate about what's happening with the Keller has been loud and divisive. So there's a lot at stake there.
Where do you see there being opportunity with the new government system and engaging with new leaders?
That's a great question. I see that there's a lot of opportunity with the new cultural plan that's in place, the Our Creative Future plan. It is a nice sort of guideline. It's important that it's had a lot of input from a lot of people. So I think there's been a lot of inclusivity in developing that plan. So I would like to see that the leaders carefully look at that. I think that it's important too to recognize that the revitalization downtown, it's not just downtown. It filters out into all the neighborhoods as well. There's a lot of vitality in Portland neighborhoods. There's a concern that if we just look at downtown, if we just look at at ways that it can be revitalized, that all the exciting, vibrant activity that's happening in the neighborhoods might be overlooked. So I think that's a key piece to engage with and figure out how to support the whole ecosystem. There's another sort of way of thinking that sometimes it means just supporting the larger arts institutions, which are all located downtown. And it's important that they are economically strong because they do support the smaller institutions. The whole economic ecosystem is important and vital, but that's also not where everything happens. So it's important to have a bigger picture of the entire arts community, that it's big and small, that it's downtown and elsewhere, that there's a broad geographic location, and that it's all forms of arts. It's performing arts, it's dance, it's music, it's visual arts, it's galleries, it's a cultural activity, it's KBOO radio, it's all of the things that go into making the city vibrant and engaging.
What are the takeaways that you hope folks get from this opinion piece that you wrote and thinking about arts going into this election?
That's a good question. So this consortium or group of arts leaders have developed a brief that, and we have partnered with this group of leaders to publish the brief. They have sent it to current members of City Hall and to candidates coming up to help to inform them. And we have partnered with this group to publish it and so that it's made public for anybody to look at. And I think it's important to educate people about the role of the arts, that it plays a huge part in the city economy. There's a study that I cite in the story, Americans for the Arts, that arts groups throughout the city participated in. And according to this study, Portland nonprofit groups generate at least $405 million in economic revenue. And that is nearly half for the whole state. And granted, that's just nonprofit groups. That's not for profit. The whole creative economy includes the film industry, includes advertising agencies, includes designers, architects. So it's a much bigger economic impact. From this study, I guess only about a third of nonprofits responded to it. So you can imagine that the impact is actually much bigger. I would also say, too, that RAC helped to promote that study and encourage people to participate. So that advocacy piece that they play is huge in the region, and it's needed for that cohesiveness for everybody to come together. We can't advocate for ourselves if we don't have this kind of information readily available. So I would hope that this piece would educate the public at large and candidates about the role that the arts play, that it has a huge economic impact, that there's a lot at stake. There's a lot in flux right now in the arts community. We're kind of waiting to see how things play out. But there's also a lot of support that needs to happen so that arts groups can come back as they were before the pandemic, so that they can be stronger and more resilient and add to the vibrancy of the city. The brief that this arts group's developed also, it's actually very worthwhile to indicate just the value of the arts, what it brings. There's the social impact, there's the mental health impact, behavioral impact. It helps people to learn. It helps kids to learn. It helps them to stay in school. There's just an enormous impact that the arts have in developing the social fabric of our city. And that's what I would hope that people would get out of it.
If our listeners are interested in reading it for themselves or learning more about Oregon Arts Watch, where can they do that?
You can find us at orartswatch.org. We have a lot of stories about the arts. We do arts journalism that is available online. And the whole election topic is available. We have ads on the site that you can click to so that you can read the brief. And then we'll have all of the feedback from the candidates available to read their views on the arts. orartswatch.org.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was Oregon Arts Watch Executive Director Laura Grimes speaking with me about an opinion piece. It's called "The Arts Community Has a Lot at Stake in the Election That Will Reshape Portland City Hall." With many new faces taking the helm, arts leaders make a case for why culture plays a significant role in the city's economy. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 21st. Your contribution